This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to 3-Pre-1-Cast. This podcast is your pit stop for a comedic but educational take on the crazy and illustrious world of Formula One.
We will take you through the latest news and happenings, while also offering our views and perspectives on the key moments, both on and off the track. So, to quote the great David Croft of Sky Sports F1,
it's lights out and away we go.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of 3-Pre-1-Cast with all three pre's in the studio today. How are we doing, lads?
Very good, thank you.
Mighty fine.
Great to all be back together.
Yes, for one final episode in the same room until we start travelling abroad and maybe doing shows online. But yes, we're in the studio today.
Absolutely,
together.
It'll be good. And do you know what's special about this podcast beyond the point we just talked about?
What's that?
Maybe... probably like 7 episodes ago, I said, episode 14. We have to get to episode 14.
That's what you said.
Do you remember why? Do you remember why?
That's like the threshold at where podcasts succeed or
yes,
something.
Yes, absolutely. Was and it? It's 50% of podcasts don't make it to episode 14. So
what
we
a milestone.
We're now in the top 50% of all podcasts
top
ever.
Top 50%. 1 in 2. That's us.
Yeah.
Good congratulations, lads.
We've done well. We've done well.
So it's only taken us what? 3 or 4 months to do the first 50%, so another 3 or 4 months and we'll be number one in the world.
Exactly.
Number one
that's
in the world.
Number one podcast ever.
Watch out, Joe Rogan.
Yeah, episode 28. Here we are.
Here we are.
Right, lads, so we had the Mexican Grand Prix a few days ago.
No, I'm just going to cut you off straight away. I was waiting for you to do this. It's actually the Mexico City Grand Prix this year. There's a bit of a change. And
so,
I guess
set in Mexico City.
The only reason I wanted to bring that up is I have no idea why they did it, and I just want to know why.
Because every other Grand Prix, you name it after the country, like the Austrian Grand Prix.
There's some exceptions, like they do, like they've called it before the, I think it was in Baku where they called it their, no, that's not right. There's definitely another one where they've called it after the city instead of the Singapore. Well,
what about Zandvoort? Zandvoort?
Yeah, well, no, that's the Dutch Grand Prix.
No, but isn't it also called the Zandvoort Grand Prix?
No.
Oh.
No, so I think it's,
but anyway,
you call it like the country Grand Prix or the track just by
track
itself.
Yeah. It tends to be the country
Imola,
Grand Prix, but then there's the, well, like Imola's an exception because it's in Italy, but it's not the Italian Grand Prix, it's the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix, which is a region.
Oh, and that's right, and then the Monza is known as the Italian Grand Prix.
Yeah,
so there's all these things, but it's an interesting thing that this weekend, it's because it's previously been the Mexican Grand Prix, but this weekend it was the Mexico City Grand Prix.
Interesting.
And it just, you heard the commentators really straining to add the city in there, you know.
I don't know
just
why.
Seems very pointless. But anyway, so that's my interesting fact for the show. I've contributed.
There we go. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen.
So let's go to analysing the race itself.
Yeah.
So obviously Max Verstappen winning again by a huge margin, just with a dominant performance. Right.
Are you guys getting some deja vu listening to that? Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I think he won by so much because Mercedes got it wrong.
They fumbled
on strategy.
The bag.
I think they made a bold, or they tried to make a bold call. They tried to do something maybe a little bit unexpected, and it just didn't work out for them.
It seemed to be away from what their plan was going into the race, because I think it was Toto who said that they don't care if they sacrifice one of the drivers' races for the other one to succeed, which suggested that they would have a split strategy and have one on one strategy, one on the other. And in the end, they just kind of put them both on a lackluster one, and it was just a bit lame, really.
Okay.
Yeah. I think, though, it was interesting because what they could have done is they brought Hamilton in, did they bring Russell in first? No, they must have brought Hamilton in first. That's right, because it was Red Bull who brought Perez in. Anyway, they brought Hamilton in first, and what we've seen previously in some races is then they would leave Russell out and they would sacrifice his race so that because he stayed out, he gets track position over everyone who pits, and then they catch him up. So when Verstappen gets to Russell, Russell would then hold him up. The difference is that now we have far more DRS zones, and it's easier to overtake. So it's not as effective as what it used to be a few years ago, when because the cars were harder to overtake, even if you had way worse tyres, you could still hold someone up. Probably the most recent famous example we saw of it was, I'm pretty sure Red Bull did it in the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix last year when they needed to hold Hamilton up against Verstappen. So they used Perez that role.
Yeah.
And they sort of ruined his race, because at the end of the day, all they needed to do was win that race with Max. They didn't care. You know,
Perez was the ultimate team player.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, yeah. I think I've got that right, that they used that similar sort of strategy.
Yeah.
But I was surprised that Mercedes didn't do that. But at the same time, I don't know how effective it would have been, because there's three DRS zones in Mexico. Those medium tyres were going off for Russell. Verstappen would have breezed straight past Russell had they tried that. But then to put both of them on the hard tyre and run the exact same strategy, I thought that was, you know, you kind of, like, they should have tried something different with Russell, if it didn't work out with Hamilton, it wasn't going to work out with him either. So try something different, and maybe one of them would have succeeded.
But so was it quite interesting that Perez couldn't get past Hamilton?
I was surprised that Verstappen could pull such a gap on Hamilton and keep pulling away from Hamilton, but then Hamilton could build a gap on Perez.
It's such a slow track, though. You know, like, I think it's actually quite difficult to overtake that. You know, you don't have as much grip going into the corners as well, so you can't necessarily throw it as hard in.
Not necessarily. Like, I think we saw lots of overtaking in the race, in terms of, especially down that main, because you get the double DRS through the first main straight and the second main straight. I don't think overtaking was the problem. I think, personally, I just think Perez didn't have the pace.
You reckon?
To get Hamilton, yeah. His pace was clearly not as good as Verstappen's was, because Verstappen was building a gap to Hamilton, and Hamilton was holding up Perez, Perez couldn't get past him.
The Red Bull's advantage is in the frontline speed, we know that.
Yeah.
Around the corners, it's a lot more even. Mercedes prefer that. They prefer that.
That's true, and I guess
downforce, so
Perez had the dirty air, that probably makes a difference, but
I mean, did you guys see that kind of good sort moment where some of the crowd were booing Hamilton?
I did see that, yeah.
Obviously, it's Perez's home race. They were supporting, rooting for him.
Yeah.
But then Perez kind of, like, he put
the finger up,
Yeah, kind of told off the crowd a little bit, which is quite nice. But I did hear that Perez was able to get on the podium again, so he's been able to get there quite a few times.
He got there last year for the first time.
Oh, okay.
So the podium this year was the exact same as it was last year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Exact same positions.
Yeah, because I think this is Verstappen's fourth win in Mexico as well. I think he had the record for three wins.
Oh, okay. And now I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah, because what is it? He's racked up win number 14 for the season, right?
In this race. And he's gotten a record for the most points of any driver.
Yeah. It's also the most wins of any one driver in one season
I thought Vettel had that record.
Vettel did have that record. He got 13 in 2013, and Schumacher got 13 in 2004.
Wow. Oh, and they would have had less races.
They did have less races, So they did it. Verstappen, because Verstappen got to 13 with the US Grand Prix, and that would have been, I think, the 19th. The US Grand Prix was essentially what would have been the end of the season for Vettel.
Yeah.
And I think Schumacher did it with one less race in 2004.
Yeah.
So Verstappen has had more races, and he sort of pointed to that in his comments, we're doing more races now than they
did. But if he goes and wins the next and the final two races of the season, then it's surely, like, you know...
it'd be interesting to see percentage-wise what it compares. Yeah. I haven't done that math, but...
he would have definitely set a huge benchmark for anyone else that wants to try beat
absolutely.
His record.
But then I question, like, it's a good record, but at the same time, it also depends hugely on who your teammate is. You know, like, Lewis doesn't have that record because...
Rosberg was quite a competitive teammate.
Yeah, when in 2016, Mercedes won all but two races, but because Rosberg and Hamilton were fighting for the championship between themselves, you know, that record,
he got a few wins taken from him.
Though actually, and now that you're mentioning taken wins, and I'm thinking stolen, did you see the story about Max Verstappen boycotting Sky Sports
F1?
No,
I
did not see that.
So Max Verstappen is now boycotting, wasn't doing interviews with Sky Sports F1 because Ted Kravitz, or this is all implied, but it hasn't been stated outright, but the implication is because Ted Kravitz, who's a pundit on Sky F1, did a segment where he described, he was talking in the context of like a Hollywood movie script, and he was saying how perfect the 2021 season was when Verstappen got robbed. Hamilton got robbed right at the end. And Verstappen's gone. I'm being disrespected. It's constant, you know, disrespect towards me. I'm not.
I think another part of the constant disrespect was all this kind of talk of the budget cap being exceeded last year, and if that contributed to maybe Red Bull stealing the championship.
Some people, drew the line there as well. Yeah,
and Sky Sport had been fueling some of those questions, which has also upset him. But yeah, it's definitely a lot of this undermining Verstappen's victory last year.
I think it's kind of good though, right? Like, it's I like Charles Leclerc, but you wouldn't see him ever pulling stuff like that if he would never boycott like the Sky broadcast.
I like the stash, in of itself. I kind of like that drama.
Yeah,
like, it's quite interesting. Yeah.
Also, if you've got a Formula One world champion, you want them to be a bit of a diva. You want them to be a little bit, a little bit cutthroat. I think it's good.
And it's worth noting as well that Max was backed up by Christian Horner and by Sergio Perez. Like, it wasn't just him. It was all of Red Bull.
Well, I think they're probably all, Horner especially is sick of media questions as well, because he's under the pump for, this controversy.
Well, the cost cap, there are some valid questions to ask there. They were the only team that broke it.
Aston Martin's slightly broke.
Well, but Aston Martin's is a procedural breach, so it's a little bit different, because it's down to how they filed things, not spending too much money, which is what Red Bull did. But the interesting thing, although they spent, I think it was £1.8 million over the cost cap, the FIA also found that if they had got a tax calculation right, which they got it wrong, if they got it right, it would have reduced the cap back to about 400k, or the breach to 400k.
Oh, man.
So it's quite an interesting thing. But I mean, the sense I'm getting, I'm rambling on cut me off if you want. But the sense I get, and I still haven't had this proven black or white, which has been my biggest thing, is that I don't think Red Bull gained a clear on-track advantage from the spending, because it related to catering costs and confusion over that, a tax issue, something to do with spare parts and the heritage side of things. But it just isn't, it's not like they spent $2 million extra dollars on a new front wing, which gave them half a second of lap time sort of thing.
I think
it's not that clear cut. So it's hard to know, though, if what advantage they did gain from it.
Yeah, last week we talked about, Steve, you and me, about how, we were sort of trying to pick, like, what will be the penalty, what will be the fine. And now that we've seen it, do you think it's then a bit unjustified? How much? Because they've kind of on multi-levels been
I thought the fine, actually, I thought what they got punished with was fair enough.
The 10% aerodynamic testing limit, Horner has called it draconian.
Yes.
As a punishment. And I've just searched up the definition because I don't know. So that is excessively harsh and severe.
Yeah.
So he's definitely upset about that, isn't he?
Yeah. So the key way to think about it is, a new thing F1's introduced is basically the aerodynamic testing time you get allocated to develop your car. And essentially, you'd think the more aero time you have, the more testing time, the better you're going to get your car developed. And at the moment, the time allocations are based on where you finish in the championship. So Red Bull, by winning the championship, already have the less amount of time.
Yep.
Essentially, there's a baseline time. The baseline is given to seventh place. So Williams, finishing last, they get 115% of that baseline time, whereas Red Bull gets 70%. And because it's a 10 percentage reduction, it takes them down to 63%.
Oh, wow.
So it's a reduction of the percent. So it's a 10% reduction of 60%. 10% of 60% is only 7%. It's very confusing on the numbers,
so
but
it's
essentially,
not just a straight 10% off.
It's very confusing. But I can't even explain.
I think I understand that now.
But essentially,
I'm glad you saw my confused look.
So the way you've got to think about it is, Ferrari gets 75% testing time. Mercedes will get 80%. It's in 5%.
Mercedes don't overtake.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. It's in 5% increments. So Red Bull would have been 70%, but now they're losing another 8%.
Which he said will reduce their...
7%, I can't count.
What he said it would reduce their time.
He reckoned half a second was Horner's claim. But, I mean, you know, how long's a piece of string? You can't really put a number on that, I don't think. But
I'm just reading the sort of summary of the fine. So they're being fined $7 million, and the overspend was 1.8.
Business loss.
Yeah, I mean...
But the fine is clearly a deterrent, and I think there is reason for the FIA, because this is the first time it's happened, to take a strong action.
Yeah.
You know, show that they're not going to take people. You know, they're not going to
set an example.
They're not going to settle.
You can't play with it and just go, oh, I was 10K.
Because if they went, oh, Red Bull's just a little bit over, then and you know they said, oh, we'll give you because you overspent by 400k, we'll give you a 400k fine and we'll leave it at that. Well, then everyone would get
Mercedes and Red Bull, Mercedes and Ferrari now budgeting to go over.
Exactly,
and
that's the situation they're obviously trying to avoid. And so I feel like the penalty's fair enough. A lot of people on the internet would not agree with me.
Wow,
A lot of people who said
team principals also weren't. There were
a few unhappy.
Did we touch on the fact, and I'm just reading this now, that it's actually a 10% reduction in permitted aerodynamic research?
Yeah, so that's basically aero testing.
So it's just all aero testing, so their time in the wind tunnel.
Time in the wind tunnel, and there's this other thing called, I think it's CFD, which I will see. There's some other testing element time that they have a cap on. So it's wind tunnel time and some other thing. I can't remember.
Well, they'll have to be very smart with the time they've got.
But essentially... So I guess the way to think about it is, because of the new rules, it was already tipped against them because they're so successful. And the aim of that is obviously to equalise the field a bit more.
Yeah.
And now they've had it tipped even further against them. So it'll be tough for...
Interesting to see.
It might be good for the sport, actually, because it will foster... You know, it'll make it...
The other cars getting a little closer.
Yeah, in theory, it should make it easier for Ferrari and Mercedes to challenge Red Bull.
Which would be great, to have a three-way race for the...
Yeah, if those three were fighting week in, week out, and you had no idea which, you know, true six cars fighting week in, week out, that'd be amazing. Because at the moment, they've got the drivers for it. I'm getting all these tangents tonight.
They've got the drivers for it.
You've got to think about, you know, Mercedes, two great drivers there, Russell Hamilton. Sainz and Leclerc have both won races this year. And okay, Verstappen has the edge on Perez, but on his day, Perez has won races as
well. All six of them could be. I mean, they're all race winners, and they all have the potential.
Except for George Russell.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, not yet.
Not yet on Russell, he has the potential, right? You put him in the right car.
I think undeniably Russell will win some races in his career, right?
Yeah.
If not a championship, if Mercedes get their act together. But I mean, there's obviously been some other stuff happening as well throughout the race. We had another DNF from good old Fernando Alonso, who's had some rotten luck this season.
Though he got a little bit of luck, speaking of FIA.
Oh, this was crazy. Yeah,
that's quite unprecedented. So they reversed the decision to give him a 30-second penalty, and he got back into the seventh place position, days after the race.
It was very, I didn't follow that one as closely, admittedly, but essentially, he got hit with the penalty. And then they revoked the penalty. So he went from 7th to 15th or whatever, back to 7th. I think he must have been 15th when we recorded last week.
Yeah.
So for anyone listening, he's, you know, been reinstated back to 7th. Which, the other thing worth mentioning, that could make a huge difference in the championship.
Massively.
Because that fight between McLaren and Alpine is so close. 7 points, I think, gives you six. Finishing 7th, I think, gives you 6 points, I want to say.
Go 1, 2...
Well, it's 1 for 10th, 2 for 9th, 4 for 8th.
Might be
6. I'm pretty sure it's 6 for 7th place. 6 points, that can make a huge difference in the McLaren-Alpine fight.
The difference now is 7 points Alpine ahead of McLaren.
Yeah, there you
go.
Wow,
look at that.
Does it tell you there how many points you get?
Yeah, you get 6 points.
Yeah, it's 6 points.
You get 6 points, yeah. So
that's true. It's not just for Alonso, it's for the whole team and the whole championship.
Yeah,
so there's a bit of luck for Alonso, but like you say, Rory... he had a good race, didn't he, at Mexico?
Well, he was having a good race, He was, I think, in the points when he retired. But we've seen it from Alpine a few times this year now, where the car just is unreliable.
Well, some people I was reading online were suggesting that potentially it's his driving style, or that he's actually pushing the car too hard, which is actually leading to a lot of these.
I haven't heard that theory, but I could see that. Yeah, because he has a very aggressive style. He has a very unique aggressive style.
Yeah.
And so you would expect that would probably strain the car.
Ocon hasn't had anywhere near the same amount of issues as Fernando Alonso has. So, I mean, you know, and I think now, and like you've been probably seeing some stuff in the media, the bridges are fairly burnt between him and Alpine, because now he's making comments of that problems are only on one side of the garage, it seems, and stuff like that. So it's classic Nando.
Alonso, yeah, he's quite diva-like at the moment. He said something about Hamilton as well. And then did you see Hamilton tweeted a response, which was just the picture of Hamilton on first on the podium looking down on Alonso in second?
Oh, I didn't see that.
I haven't seen that. But I did hear about the stoush, because what Alonso said that...
Oh, that Verstappen's two championships were more better deserved wins than any of Hamilton's.
Yeah.
Which is like, what?
Wow. Because out of nowhere, just... No one asked, but he just came out with
it. Can't get over it, can he? From 2008, or was it 7 or 8?
2007, where they had their big spat. Yeah. Hamilton and Alonso were teammates.
Alonso is on his diva.
He hasn't forgiven, has he? He's not moved on. It's
a little bit like, you got to move on.
Yeah.
You know?
He's like 42 or something, still trying to race, and he just can't get over 2007.
Yeah. So, the other news, I mean, admittedly, Mexico was a little bit boring. I've seen a few comments saying, like, oh, it's interesting they could get 6 minutes of highlights from that race.
What about, I thought the one man who did produce some highlights, finally, Daniel Ricciardo.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I think, like, he had a lot of help because he was on the soft tyre, but he still was making these moves, and then he... I was surprised that he got hit with such a penalty for that. I could sort of see what he was doing with, like, he's sort of going, you know, I'm here, mate, give me the space, you're going to have to run wide, and then I can get you on the exit. But Tsunoda gave him no space. I was surprised the stewards were so harsh on Ricciardo.
The weirdest thing about it is the week before, when George Russell yeeted into Carlos Sainz.
And then blamed Sainz again.
Yeah, but got a 5-second penalty. Daniel Ricciardo does almost the same thing a week later and gets a double.
I think there's one big difference there, which I agree with the stewards taking this line, which is that they're always a little bit less lenient on first lap crashes because it's the chaos of the start. And so they have shown, I feel that that's always been a sort of precedent, that the penalties will be not as harshly applied on the first lap.
Right, because they don't want to necessarily just ruin the racing.
Well, not because I think it's because they recognise that the start is so, you know, you're dealing with 20 cars around you.
Yeah, that makes
versus
sense.
Versus when it's, you know, just, you know, that moment it was just Tsunoda and Ricciardo.
And it was a stupid move from Ricciardo. He sort of...
He stuck a wheel in and hoped
that was enough. And, yeah.
I could see what he was trying to do, but at the end of the day...
The McLaren's way quicker than the AlphaTauri down the straight, and he was about to hit a DRS zone. He literally could have just held off, waited, overtaken on the straight, and not...
Yeah. Ricciardo could have very well bottled one of his better races recently with that move.
Yeah. Did you see, I saw an interview with him afterwards where he was ecstatic because it all worked out in the end, but he was like, oh, when I got told about the penalty, I just did not respond to my engineer because I thought, like, the one race that I'm actually doing well, basically. I've screwed it up. And I was like, oh, I can't imagine what that man would have been like.
Oh, my goodness.
If like, there was a last lap safety car and the field bunches up and he drops to last because of the penalty or something. You know, like, if it had... But for those of you who don't know, he finished far enough ahead.
Ocon in eighth.
Yeah, so he could... The penalty was applied, but it didn't affect his finishing position
in the
end. Well,
he went like a cut cat after that penalty, though. He was just overtaking everybody, moving up.
Yeah, well, he got a really good strategy and was on the soft tyres and no one else was. So he was just so much quicker.
It does make me question if, you know, Lando's obviously been favoured a lot of the time on strategy this season and arguably last season, potentially because he's, you know, been potentially driving the quickest on the day as well, which is... you know, been that factor. But man, oh man, like, Ricciardo isn't a bad driver, you know, and maybe if he's got just a few more things going for him, a bit of a better strategy behind him, he can do something. Yeah. But
so maybe after all of our talk, maybe I wouldn't mind to see him in a Haas after all.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not going to happen, though.
No.
He said, he said that he's not on the grid in 2023.
Oh, okay.
He's confirmed that.
I think, was it, did we talk about this last week where he's 33 now? And it's that, it's, he's like almost at that point where it's like, you're probably too old to take a year off and come back. But equally, he could. He could take a year off and come back. Whether he does or not, I don't know.
Yeah. The theory, there's been rumours that he's going to get a reserve seat at like one of the top teams.
Mercedes, wasn't it?
Well, there was sort of a rumour around that, but I think people have thrown cold water on that, or he's thrown cold water on that. So
he probably wants to have a chill out, instead of having to be always on.
Travelling around, being not even on the grid starting.
Though I can understand wanting to be a reserve driver, because then you're still sort of in the, you've sort of got one foot in the sport, but you don't have that week in, week out pressure of
delivering race results. Depends how passionate he still is about being an F1.
Yeah.
You know, if you still really want to race as many years as possible, then
the sense I get is that he feels like he needs a year to almost like recover from this, reset from the disaster of the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And just, but he still want, like, he's still got the hunger for it, so that's why he wants to keep a foot in F1.
Because Alonso would have taken a break around this age as well.
Yeah, Alonso, so would have been earlier.
2017 he had a break, didn't he?
Sorry, Alonso would have been older than Ricciardo is then.
Yeah.
But it was, so Alonso retired, or first retirement, I think was end of 2019, I want to say, either 2018 or 2019.
I thought it was 2017.
No, it was definitely 20, he was definitely there 2018. It's whether he finished in 2018 or in 2019. I think he finished 2018, and then he came back 2021.
Yeah. So his second stint with McLaren from 2015-2018 resulted in no further success. After a two-year sabbatical, he returned in 2021.
Yeah.
So there's a little, like, you know, Ricciardo could easily take a year or two off if he wanted to follow Alonso.
Michael Schumacher had a fair amount of time.
Well, that's the thing. Schumacher retired in 2005, in 2006, retired, and everyone thought that was it, done.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't, And then he came back in 2010 when Mercedes. 2010 to 2012 with Mercedes when they joined the grid. There was also, he almost, and I still would have thought this would have been the coolest thing ever. In 2008, I think it was 2008. Or, no, it was 2009. 2009, Felipe Massa. Do you guys even know Massa?
Yeah.
I love Felipe Massa. He was a great driver. He was at Ferrari, and he got in a very unfortunate accident where he was injured and was out, and they needed to find a reserve driver. And it was kind of like this awesome moment of, like, we're going to pull Michael Schumacher out of 3 years of retirement to step in for a couple races. But then Schumacher injured his back in, like, a motorcycle crash, I think.
Oh.
He had done something that he couldn't race. I would have thought it would have been the coolest moment to be like, we're just going to pull the greatest driver of all time
as our backup
out of retirement from a couple of years and just put him in the car, and would have been great, I think.
Wow. I feel like it would be cool if they did, and maybe they do, maybe it's like on a different sort of style, but it would be awesome to get these like old racers back into their old cars and do like a, because I know they do it a lot in football, you'll get like the vintage Manchester United 11. And they'll come back and obviously play at a lot lower level. Maybe you could get like these guys back in their cars and just have them down-tuned a bit and just keep it to like a 10-lap race.
You know, a cool idea.
That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, and like you were saying, what did you say, put them all in the same car even?
Or even put them in their old cars, because all the cars keep, because they just sit in the museum, right? Like, you know, they just sit there in all the teams' garages and museums. You could definitely brush them off and do a vintage race. Yeah.
What was it? There was recently Mario Andretti, who's a Formula One world champion from the late 70s, I want to say. He's like in his, I think he's about 70 or 80 now. He's quite old. He was in like an old, oh God, I don't want to get this wrong. He was in a newer spec F1 car recently in America at Laguna Seca and was just like driving it around. I'm like, that must be amazing for someone like him.
Yeah.
Who, raced the old 70s cars and is now in a modern Formula One car.
Yeah, yeah. Equally, then, when we've seen Charles Leclerc jump into an old car this year, do you remember at Monaco when he was taking Niki Lauda's old, one of his old Ferrari race cars out, and he just binned it.
Well, it had the brake failure. I'm pretty sure it was a car failure. It
didn't bode well.
But I remember I remember that happening, yeah. Oh.
He got all his bad luck out there, though, and finally got his points at Monaco.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So one thing I wanted to talk about, lads, is we've got two races left, Brazilian and Abu Dhabi Grand Prix.
Correct.
So that's two races. And just looking at the standings here, I thought we could just have a little analysis, maybe a prediction now to see what we think will happen in the next two races and how it might impact the standings.
Yep.
So Verstappen has won. That's well and truly sorted.
Done.
Second is Perez with 280 points. Charles Leclerc is 5 points behind with 275. Then we've got Russell with 231 and Hamilton with 216 and Sainz with 212. So those are the kind of top six, and it's going to be like those six are going to be in there because seventh is Lando Norris, best of the rest at 111, so exactly half of Sainz's points.
Yeah.
So do we think that Perez is going to be able to hold on to second with
I think
lead?
So, yes.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I think that Red Bull just, it seems like each week it's just got something done a little bit different that makes it that much more, dominant is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
I would say well, just with when it comes to the Red Bulls, it seems like gradually, as obviously they've been dominant over the season, everyone's now moulding their strategy around how do we beat the Red Bull. Right, and I think if you look at the start of the year, and yes, there's been upgrades throughout the season, when Ferrari were pretty much matching or beating out the Red Bulls at the start, they were racing their own race, their own strategy, they had their own ideas around how they were going to win. Whereas now I just think everyone's so just pretty much in awe of watching the Red Bulls and just trying to pick what their strategy is going to be. I just think, you know, they're chasing, and I don't think that's going to change. I think they're going to stay chasing.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
Wow, so I mean, that has been quite a surprise, obviously. I know, Stephen, you were quite sure that Leclerc would stay ahead of Perez, but
I'm not convinced now.
Yeah.
Just based on recent, it almost looks like Ferrari are more worried about Mercedes than
I would say.
Red Bull.
I mean, look at what happened in Mexico. Enough. Like, not only did Mercedes sort of beat them out, but it was
Mercedes were comfortably ahead in Mexico.
Wow.
Mexico's just got that oddity with the elevation that always makes you a bit skeptical of like, because obviously if you look at just Mexico, Ferrari were the third quickest team. They were in fifth and sixth. They were nowhere in that race. They were nowhere near the front.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we're going to keep seeing that for the last two, just because Mexico has that oddity with the thinner air because it's so high above sea level.
So maybe Ferrari will be able to hold on to the constructors, but it doesn't look like Sainz is going to be able to overtake Hamilton, maybe, and Leclerc might not be able to overtake Perez. So
Potentially. I think Ferrari, in that question, I think Ferrari will come out ahead of Mercedes and the constructors.
Yeah, so in the constructors, they've still got a 40-point lead.
Yeah, 40-point lead. With two races, that's enough.
Yeah.
I was a bit worried a few races ago I was thinking a few races ago Mercedes might have a chance, but it hasn't worked out for them.
I think if they'd actually pulled off a win this time out, we'd be talking about Mercedes jumping Ferrari. But I think I made my prediction last week on this, Steve. But I just think they're not going to win a race now this season. Coda was a good chance, didn't happen for the track. And then again,
Mexico for me was their last, was Mercedes' last chance.
Unless Verstappen DNFs. You know, with some kind of crazy thing.
Yeah, but see, Checo, I think last two races, you'd need Verstappen and Checo to DNF, and even then I still think Charles Leclerc I'd still pick. If you had to ask me, the last two races, who would win them if we basically don't regard Red Bull? So who would finish third you know what I mean? Like, who's going to finish behind the two Red Bulls? Charles Leclerc. Both races for me.
I mean, that's fair. I mean, I don't think the tracks are suiting at all to Mercedes.
Yeah, there's not.
And I think
that's what
problem.
I'm getting at.
I think, different tracks. I think Mercedes have shown to be quicker than Ferraris, but we've got Brazil. Brazil's quick, and obviously Abu Dhabi's a pretty quick track too.
If we were racing Monaco and Hungary next, I would maybe give Mercedes a chance, but we're not, because those are the sort of tracks. Those low-speed, tight, twisty tracks are what seem to suit the Mercedes car.
So that'll be what to look for in these last two, is to see where Ferrari and Mercedes finish in relation to each other and see if they can finish.
It'll be exciting. Like, I still think it's a good battle, because I think Mercedes probably know that, right? So they will be setting their cars up in the best way possible to still try and be competitive.
And I think the other thing you've got to remember is how quickly things can change, because if Mercedes finish third and fourth, that's 15 and 12 points. So what's that, 17, it's 37, no, 27 points. 27 points. So, you know, all it would take is a double DNF for Ferrari in Brazil, which happened in 2019 when the two Ferraris collided. Oh, I don't know if it was a double DNF, but they collided in Brazil.
Wow. I mean, it was famous. A double DNF this year as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, famous. Well,
but that's even worse because they crashed, yeah.
Yeah, it was when Leclerc and Vettel came together. It was very funny. But anyway, you know, all it would take is Ferrari double DNF. Mercedes finished third and fourth, which you'd expect in that situation. That's 27 points. Suddenly the gap's down to 13, you know?
Yes, yeah.
So it's certainly close. Not settled.
Not settled just yet. So do we want to do a bit of the Beat the Boss, lads?
Oh, I think so.
Oh, yeah, I've
so
been looking forward to
time coming, eh?
I feel like I'm really feeling it. Like I was saying to you guys before the show, because we've had this wee snafu with...
people
with,
being away.
And getting everything sorted. But I initially was getting a little bit deflated, but now I'm really into it.
Absolutely. So... do you want to go first, Rory?
I will go first.
I can't see your screen, Rory. I can't see it.
All right, cool. So, Formula One cars, notoriously complicated machines.
Oh, God. This is my weakness, I think.
I want you to,
within 10,000, okay.
Tell me how many components go into making a Formula One car.
23,500. 132,000.
80,000. Oh, okay. So you have failed.
I had no idea.
Wow. So well, that's one point to us.
Okay.
Okay, here's one for you. So, woman racing in F1.
Yes.
Okay. Very few have.
Yes.
But can you name the most successful...
Layla Lombardi.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Scored 1 point in the Spanish Grand Prix of 1975.
Oh, my God. He's nailed it. He has literally done it all. Layla, yep. Need I say anything more?
I can feel the muscles controlling, smiling, like getting a bit tense there.
Wow, so that's a permanent record that he scored. Yep, good. That's one for the boss for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yep. Well, I can shaft him on another one. Okay. So we've got...
You're asking two technical questions.
I am asking that, but this has got to test your... You've got to start expanding your repertoire of Formula One knowledge, Stephen. Okay, on a Formula One steering wheel, I'll give you... Within five, how many buttons are
45.
There? That's another point for us.
Oh.
It's 2-1. There is 20.
Oh, 20 switches.
Yeah.
Buttons on the wheel.
Yeah, 20 buttons.
I would have thought there'd be more.
Yeah.
Oh, so 45 was just a random stab in the dark.
Random stab in the dark.
I thought you knew that number.
No.
You sounded very confident.
No, because, see, if I just, I have no idea, so just say something. And if I say it nice and quickly, and I'm right, it sounds great, but no one really cares if I'm wrong, right?
Fair enough.
My brother taught me that.
Well, how about this one? So, obviously, the age of drivers was a lot older back when F1 first started.
Yes.
Within, say, I'll give you like 3 years,
Is this a question about Louis Chiron?
No, this is the... average age of drivers in 1950, which was the first year...
45. 39. Okay. 39.
So
it was a bit older than current, but...
Yeah, so, I mean, there were three over 50 years old, five were over 40, and the youngest racer, Briton Geoff Crossley, was 29 years old.
Interesting. Yeah, they certainly used to be a lot older.
Yeah.
Because the oldest guy who, like, won a race, I think, is, like, 60 or
was
something.
He?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe search that. Who's the oldest...
F1 winner? Is that... Do you oldest want
F1...
Or?
Yeah, F1 driver that won a race, I'm pretty sure is a guy called Louis Chiron.
58 years old.
58, okay.
Yeah. And nearly
60.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Stephen.
Fernando Alonso might break that record.
He might well keeps going.
20 years time.
Wow.
Yeah. All right, I'll fire another one your way. What is the name of the only driver with a DNQ, DNF, and DSQ in one race?
Oh.
Could you tell me what a DSQ is?
Did not qualify.
Ah.
D or... No, so, DSQ, I don't...
So,
DNQ would be...
This driver failed to qualify, started anyway, retired, and then was disqualified.
Yeah.
So DSQ is a disqualification.
I know the story of the guy. I know I've heard it before.
You, I can give you one of two things. I can give you the year it happened or the country in which the race was.
No, give me the year that it happened.
1977.
No, I can't remember for the life of me who it is.
It's Hans Heyer.
Oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't have got
that.
Yeah,
that was a very niche one.
I've definitely heard the story, but yeah, couldn't get the guy's name.
Okay, can you tell me how did he manage that?
I don't know. can read the story if you want.
Yeah. Because there would have been a qualifying time limit, and he wouldn't have got within it.
I'm just reading that he was banned from competing. wait, why was he banned? Which ultimately translated to a lifetime ban. No, I can't.
Oh, so with precious...
Is it something in there about the 107% rule? I don't know if they would have had that back then, though. Because these days they have a rule that you have to qualify within 107% of the pole lap to qualify for the race.
Oh,
he wasn't given the official go-ahead as well. So.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, like, it's happened a couple of times before where, essentially, if you're outside the 107% time, so the thing is basically, like, add a little bit on to the pole time. And if you're not within that time, you have to ask the stewards for express permission to race, because you have effectively been found to be too slow in qualifying that you're not allowed to race. So they have to give you permission. There's a couple of times when it's happened where someone's done like an out lap, so it's really, this is like 20 seconds off the pace, and then they have a mechanical fault. And so the only timed lap they have is way outside the time, and then the stewards let them race anyway. But it used to be much more common back in the 70s and 80s that you would have to actually you'd actually have to qualify to then race. Like that was half the battle. Was to actually qualify for the race, to be quick enough, because it used to be much bigger, like, you know, now there's only tenths between the teams, but it used to be like seconds difference, and there were some teams that were just so that's why they brought in this rule, to stop those ultra slow teams from getting in,
because it'd be just dangerous to everyone else,
you know, it's not like they were a realistic contender to win.
Yeah,
interesting. So that is 3 or 4-1.
I think it's 3-1.
I've only got the one,
So do you got any more, Josh?
No, I do not.
Well, I'm going to
give
you one.
I don't like Rory's ones. His are harder.
This one is, I think, super 50-50.
Okay.
So, in the 1997 European Grand Prix...
They qualified the three of them at the same time?
Okay, another one.
it's like the most famous story.
Fair enough.
I think I talked about that one. Oh, no, I don't know if I did it.
Stephen, you could have at least let him ask the question and then gone and then answered so that you clearly got a point.
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to flex my muscles a wee bit.
That's fair enough. So, what driver amassed a massive 4 minutes and 54 seconds between first and second in a Grand Prix, which is the biggest gap?
Jim Clark.
In what year? I mean, you've achieved that. Well done.
It was... Jim Clark, oh, God, it would have been, I think he died in 66, so it must have been about 62 or 63.
Lock one of those two in.
62?
Oh, no.
63? Oh, okay.
But do you know what track it was at?
It was either at the Nürburgring or at Spa.
Why, how do you know this, man? It's at Belgium in 1963, and you pretty much said the track and the year, and obviously got the race.
That's a very random thing
that's
to
so
know.
So random. Oh, fair enough. Fair play.
That's a good round from Beat the Boss. All right. Have you got any mouse holes on the back
of the mind?
To squirrel.
I don't. I haven't thought of any in particular. But do you know the story about the question Rory asked me before about the 1997 Grand Prix? What happened there?
All right, so this can be Stephen's mouse hole.
I have a feeling I told this a few episodes ago, but maybe I didn't. I can't remember.
We'll interrupt if we recognise the story,
But anyway, so it's 1997 season was between...
I recognise it.
Jacques Villeneuve driving for Williams and Michael Schumacher at Ferrari. They're the two championship rivals. And European Grand Prix is the final race of the season, the championship decider.
European Grand Prix.
Yeah, it was hosted in Spain, but at another track, so the European Grand Prix. And anyway, in qualifying, Schumacher, Villeneuve, and Villeneuve's teammate, Heinz-Harald Frentzen, set the exact same lap time in qualifying to the thousandth of a second, so that's 3 decimal points.
Wow.
all three of them set the exact same time. And there's always been this sort of like theory or rumor that like it was a timing glitch and so it didn't really happen. That's never been proven.
I reckon the odds of that must be like over 1
crazy.
Million.
Apparently, the telemetry in team telemetry had it down to 5 decimal points, and someone did go in and figure out who actually was the quickest. Because the way they did it in those days was if it was, well, the way they still do it, is if you're, if you set the same exact same time as someone else, whoever set it first is effectively ahead.
Ah.
And so we saw that happen in Mexico. Schumacher and Vettel set the exact same lap time in qualifying, but one of them was ahead because they set it first. I can't remember who. But
imagine if they did it by alphabetical order. Then you'd just be really rough.
Well, yeah, like Sebastian Vettel would probably feel a bit hard done by, wouldn't he, with V? But, yeah, anyway, and then so what happened in the 1997 Grand Prix, the interesting things didn't stop in qualifying. During the race, one of the most infamous incidents in Formula One, some would say a dark day for Formula One, some would say not so much. Very controversial day for Formula One.
I think I know what it is.
So, I don't know if I recall this enough to actually remember it, but no, Jacques Villeneuve was behind Schumacher and he made a lunge to try and get past. He was on the inside and Schumacher turned in and they collided and Schumacher went out and Villeneuve's car was damaged, but it was enough for him to limp home and win the championship. And I don't want to get this wrong, but I have a feeling that I'm pretty sure I'm right that Schumacher was eventually disqualified from the championship for the move.
Oh. See, I remember,
but essentially, there was this allegation. There was the rumors or the sort of. I just want to stress that, like, yeah, I'm not trying to be. It's hard to know what is true and what is false. But some people allege that Michael did it deliberately. He's thinking because if both of them didn't finish the race, Michael would win the championship.
Yeah.
So they're thinking Michael's going, oh my goodness, he's on the inside. I'm going to turn into him, take him out.
But that's not the first time that he might have pulled a stunt like that.
Well, that's the thing. He was accused of it.
Reputation.
He was accused of it in 1994, where he also collided with his title rival in the final race. And in that occasion, both of them did go out, and so Michael won the championship. So it worked. So, well, if that's what he did
do. It's the kind of thing you do in a video game when, like, say you and us three are racing and I'm getting.
I know Steve's
going to
win, so you just
turn
into
that's
him.
Exactly. Because there's no consequence. Yeah.
And look, there's people to this day who will be adamant that Michael did it deliberately. There will be people to this day who are adamant that it wasn't deliberate. It was just a racing
incident. I
wonder
what Mick Schumacher would say.
Well,
I think he would probably defend his dad.
Well, yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
But it's nonetheless, it's a hugely controversial moment. Mm. And yeah, some people say that it shows, you know, bad sportsmanship from Michael. But it's hard to.
It's kind of, it's,
you know, what,
well looked
it's hard
at
to know
in the
what,
movie,
yeah.
The Schumacher movie. They look at it, they look at both sides, so they get interviews from both. So yeah, it's one of those ones you can't ever get to the bottom of.
And for many people, I mean, it. As history would say, he tried it, well, you know, this sort of thing happened twice. Once it worked and once it didn't. So there's kind of a nice balance in that.
Kind of happy for Jack.
It's not like, it would be worse if both times Michael had benefited from it.
Yeah.
Or if both times Michael had lost from it, you know, it would make this argument a lot more divisive, I think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's almost a nice harmonious balance in that one worked and one didn't.
Yeah,
who knows what he was trying to do?
It definitely is like a winning mindset as well. Like, if he did it on purpose, then you can see that shows how badly he wanted to win. That he was willing to risk, you know,
his and someone else's life.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things you can analyze about. Yeah, the character it takes.
Yeah. The other interesting thing that I love from that race, and we don't see as much of this anymore, but there was a really interesting deal done before the race where Williams said to McLaren, I wish I knew the exact details, but I don't. But essentially, Williams and McLaren did a deal to, like, help us out. Like, because Williams wanted to win, McLaren probably didn't want Ferrari to win, so they were kind of with Williams. And in the end, the Williams drivers moved over to let McLaren drivers through to win the race.
And who did that? Sorry, who did that?
So the team principals of Williams and McLaren basically did a deal to, like, don't get in. Like, basically, McLaren would stay out of Williams' way if Williams would help them. they're on the same team. But then Ferrari did a similar thing. There's an allegation, and again, I want to stress this is only an allegation. There's an allegation that Ferrari got a driver, I think they were driving for Sauber, I want to say. They were driving for a team that had Ferrari engines, and the accusation is that Ferrari ordered this guy, you will not be driving for this team if you don't hold Jacques Villeneuve up. And he held Jacques Villeneuve up, and it's always been controversial as to whether, you know, why he held Villeneuve up. But so it's an interesting political landscape. In terms of what was going on.
We've always known Formula One is just a game of politics as much as it's a game of speed.
I mean, ask Bottas, about team orders and doing things, politics, stay in the team.
I mean, politics as well. I mean, look what we've had in Mexico with the cost cap. I mean, that's been hugely political. If you've got Christian Horner on one side, oh, we didn't gain any advantage, and it's
Zach
all,
Brown on the other.
You know, Zach Brown going, they have cheated.
They've cheated, yeah.
Throw the book at them, and this is the biggest scandal, and Christian Horner's going, nothing to see here. And, you know, like, I'm kind of of the view, I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. I don't think they're, you know...
You know what they say, right? Well, there's three sides to every story.
Oh. Well, I say this to you fair. A lot. This is my thing.
Yeah.
So. For those of you who don't know, that's their side, your side, and the truth.
Which sits somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, well, I think we kind of actually nailed it a little bit on the head earlier, lads. I think it's more the fact, you're going to have all the other teams calling for the book to be thrown at them. You've got Red Bull who will say it's unfair. And then you've got the FIA who are going... Well,
who've made a ruling, made a punishment.
They're also going to make an example out of them, and because they're trying to create that fear from people doing it again. So I thought
it was interesting that the FIA said it quite strongly that Red Bull did not try to defraud them. Red Bull were cooperative, and there was no allegation that Red Bull deliberately tried to mislead the FIA.
Well, so they don't like it when you try to do things outside of and try to fool the FIA.
What I'm saying is that they're saying, and I think this has some weight as the governing body, that they're saying that this wasn't like Red Bull trying to get away with something deliberate. Like, it wasn't like they go,
like,
we're gonna
say the Spygate scandal, was it this, with McLaren, and that was trying to get away with something.
There was a lot more, obviously the engineer from Ferrari knew what he was kind of doing, whereas I think the difference to make is the FIA is saying it wasn't like Red Bull went, oh, we're going to spend $1 million more, we know what we're doing, but we're going to try and use clever accounting. And that didn't happen is what the FIA said.
Well, I mean, I kind of noticed in Drive to Survive that it's almost like these principals have an obligation to put pressure on when other teams get away with things, even if they might not even agree with what they say. They put as much pressure on as possible to try gain even the tiniest advantage.
Well, why would it benefit McLaren to have the absolute book thrown at Red Bull, to have everything stripped of them, the strictest, to have more strict penalties? Because Red Bull's leading the championship, McLaren are not. So the further you can bring Red Bull down, the more benefit it is for McLaren, for example.
Yes,
exactly. Like, every other team is going to benefit from pulling Red Bull down further, by advocating for stronger penalties.
And Horner
from the cost
would
cap,
do that even when Mercedes were dominant a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
He would complain for
it's
anything.
It's politics, so, politics, and that's
politics.
The thing.
You have to really have quite a lot of, no shame to be able to perform in the politics there and not be embarrassed by what you're saying.
You have to be so biased. That's how it kind of looks,
because you're clearly a hypocrite.
You have to be biased to your own team.
Hugely. So it's a funny world, but it makes a good Netflix show.
Yeah, sure it's does. Like when McLaren were like being so proactive for the cost cap, and it's like, well, hang on, you're the leading midfield team that would benefit from the front runners not being able to spend as much. Of course, you want the cost cap. Definitely politics.
Can't blame either of them. Though I kind of appreciated Toto Wolff not being too vocal about it. I think he said that.
A lot of respect
for
them,
not enough for.
Yeah, he said if it was them, yes, of course it's hard. It's harsh for them, but if it was us, if it's us, if it's us, we think it's not enough. Mm. I think it's a fair point.
It's a good one.
It's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Red Bull said, "Oh, this is too harsh," and other teams said, "No, it's not good enough."
Bringing it back round to the racing, just briefly, guys. Yeah. A driver who struggled in Mexico is Pierre Gasly. He's kind of struggled all season. It's not been great. I can't recall exactly where he finished in Mexico. Let's have a look. He was actually down.
And that's sort of the thing with Gaz, like, almost that's the point.
P11, right?
But that's sort of the point there, you know. You're not noticing where he's finishing. Yeah. You're not remembering his before. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to think, actually, can I remember Gasly from that race? Well, what did he do?
Oh, there was that one thing where he cut off, was it Stroll or someone, and he got himself a penalty because he forced another driver off the track.
Right.
Was that right, Rory?
Yeah, I was just searching something up just around Pierre Gasly, though, because he's actually on 11 penalty points. So, and it's, you can total up to 12 in the space of a year before you earn yourself a race ban. But no driver's accumulated 12 penalty points before and had a race ban.
No one ever has
No one ever. So it's going to be really interesting to see, like, if, so I guess his options are, he either gets lucky and doesn't get any more points and doesn't have to, because that's the thing, these points last until I think it's like March next year.
I think it's like each one is basically like has a valid time period when it's awarded.
Yeah.
So like they'll stay on for a year, and it's basically if he's just got one in Mexico, that's going to be there until Mexico next year.
Yeah.
Wow. But one that he might have got in the first race of the season will only be there until early next year.
But he's currently sitting on 11.
Yeah.
Which means he's been doing a lot of what kind of things constitute.
Not really known as being a dirty driver, I'd say. I think he's probably been a bit clumsy with a few things, but and maybe just caught up in a few racing incidents that have not gone his way. But yeah, it's interesting because now I guess he's posed with either change your racing style. Or not care, because I don't know, it's a tough one. Because I think AlphaTauri probably don't care, because to them, they actually are meant to be competing with Alpine. They probably want him to take those points over to Alpine next year. If you're going back to politics, you're probably going to put him on a super aggressive strategy and hope he brings points with him next year.
Yeah, that's called playing chess and not checkers.
I see what you mean.
Like,
with the penalty point.
Bring it back into our political chat. Like,
who knows what kind of, that would be insane if they've actually planned that out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it will be interesting to see if Gasly can make more of an impact next year at Alpine.
Yeah, he's just had a very quiet, under-the-radar year this year, whereas the last few years, sort of post being demoted from Red Bull, he's almost been building his reputation.
He's been punching
up
above his weight, I'd say.
Yeah, punching above, and this year definitely not been adding to that.
For sure, there was a good while where we were like, man, he's showing Red Bull they made the wrong decision.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think he can still have a great next year, and potentially Alpine will be even better for him. You know, like, I think.
Yeah.
It's a huge opportunity.
It is a huge opportunity.
Huge opportunity for him to basically, to relaunch his career properly. Yeah.
It's as high as, it's the best of a seat as he could possibly probably get.
With all the other ones basically being filled.
Yeah.
Unless he managed to secure McLaren. But, I mean, Alpine's just as good.
Those top three teams are secured for a long time.
They're young guys in there, you know, bar Lewis, sure.
Yeah, Lewis is probably the most at-risk one of leaving, though he just came out this weekend and said that he wants to stay for a couple
more
years.
And it'll be a multi-year contract or something.
So, I mean, we could be stuck with, that sounds like a bad thing, but like, we could have those six drivers at the top three teams for a couple of years, maybe.
Yeah, we could.
Names. Yeah, we'll be talking about all these same names and teams.
That's what we hope, right?
Just imagine how the rivalry will grow, though, over those 2 years.
Thing. It's, the best thing would be if, Max has won it this year, next year Charles wins it, and then next year George Russell wins it, and then Lewis comes back, retires, and then Carlos Sainz nicks it, and then by then McLaren sorted it out, now Lando is
El Piastri.
Can you imagine if we come back to this show in like 7 years, and that has exactly happened,
verbatim.
Like, literally
that
verbatim.
That would go viral, that would be amazing. So
at this point in time, you cannot rule out that could happen.
No, that's true.
No,
that's true.
That could realistically happen.
You also can't rule out that Williams turn it around next year and they're a championship-winning team.
And,
it's unlikely.
And Albon gets it.
or even, you know, Sargent has a terrible, the joke I'm getting, or Albon or someone has something that takes them out of the seat, they have to call up Nicholas Latifi.
Takes out
the championship.
That's amazing.
Probably unlikely, but possible.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, guys. It's been good. We've got two exciting races to go, and we'll be very eagerly watching them. Now, I think the future of the show, it'll be probably me and Stephen next week. We'll try and maybe figure out a way we can bring Josh.
Yeah, I think we can dial you in.
We'll try and dial Josh in. That'll be amazing. And
yeah, I don't want to miss out on this, lads.
No. We'll see off the season. It's going to be it'll still be a very exciting end, despite Max wrapping it up. There's a lot to still go.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks, lads, for coming in. And yes, we'll catch you at the next one, eh?
Absolutely. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to 3Pre1Cast. If you want to catch up on any of our episodes, check us out on Plains FM, Apple Podcast, or Spotify.
Come and say hi to us on Instagram and TikTok at 3Pre1Cast.